Okay, do we start?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, so I knew that many people are going to talk about universal patterns here, and so I decided I'm going to talk about non-universal features of seismicity. The motivation to talk about non-universal features is that if we learn how to recognize non-universal features that are specific to some part of the system, we will be able to extract much more information that is available by simply looking at global averages that lead to universal behavior of the type we've seen. So I'll start by maybe spending 5, 6, 7 minutes on introduction, general introduction, and then I will jump to the meat of the talk, which are observational results that are derived together with Ilya Zaliapin. So there are two basic models for essentially earthquake physics that almost everybody is using. One model is essentially a planar interface, typically associated with friction in elastic of space or any other medium. This type of model, that's a classical model, is motivated by the elastic rebound theory. It's too simple. It gives only one type of dynamic behavior, essentially associated with limit cycles. The other type of model that is very popular is essentially a model associated with scale invariant structure and processes. This model, too, leads to a single dynamic regime, essentially power laws of everything. So I like to argue that these are end member regimes. They are simple end member cases. Each of them has a single dynamic regime. Actually, what is happening in the crust of the Earth, and maybe in some of the laboratory experiments that people are making, is that we have evolutionary processes. So during the formation, lots of things are changing. The geometry of the deforming zone is changing, and many other things are changing. So when you, if you take this into account, there is actually greater dynamic richness and complexities that include specifically these end member cases. Actually, lots of evidence that we have indicates that when faults are created, they begin very disordered. So we start with this type of behavior, and then with time, they evolve gradually to this type of behavior. They never get there. There are lots of things that happen in between. So using data from very large space-time domains can lead to loss of information and apparent scale invariant that at least partially is produced by averaging, by the fact that we are throwing lots of stuff together. If we have systems or dynamics that are associated with specific scales, bumps of the type we've seen earlier, and I'll show you a few more, but if you have a very heterogeneous system and subparts of the system have different bumps and you combine it all together, you will move toward power law type behavior. So if we learn from theory how to have proper selection criteria that will allow us to come to the crust of the Earth or some domain in laboratory experiment and select specific subdomains, if we have such criteria, if we learn how to understand dynamic regime and the controlling parameters, a small set of controlling parameters, we will be able to get more detailed region-specific information. So here's an example of some results that can be viewed in many different ways. This is seismicity in Southern California. These are real data, 20 years of data, very accurate location. There are about 110,000 earthquakes here. Each dot is an earthquake. What you see here is that, first of all, seismicity is clustered in space. The other thing that you see, here's the San Andreas. That's the spine of the plate boundary. You see that it does not have a lot of seismicity in the last 20 years where this data are collected. All of these regions actually fail with very big, large earthquake ruptures that occur about every 200 years. In between, there's almost nothing here. We know that they fail in large earthquake ruptures because geologists dig trenches and they see many historical earthquakes buried underneath. But in the last 50 years, this is very quiet. Instead, the seismicity is concentrated in regions with large geometrical complexity. If you look at, this is all the same data. This is in space. Here you have magnitude as a function of time. So you see that there are temporal variations. The most conspicuous temporal variations are aftershock sequences. So when we have big earthquakes, denoted by the boxes, you can see the location of the boxes right here. After the earthquake, there is a period of elevated seismicity rates that follow the Omori law that Jan was showing you. But it's not the whole story. There are some other relatively large events, the ones that are denoted here with diamonds, that actually do not have aftershocks. So I'm showing you that there is lack of universality. You don't see in space, there is different type of behavior here in time. We have typically aftershocks, but not always. This is a frequency, the moment magnitude statistics. It follows more or less power law, other than this annoying bump right here at the end that almost always exists. Now, this is from the whole of Southern California. The bump is probably a statistical artifact. But if we start looking at subdomains, if we select data from specific subpart of the system, actually these bumps get more enhanced. And they resemble what we see in some laboratory experiments. So here is an example from the Parkfield section of the San Andreas Fault. This is very straight section. Seismicity is super localized. The entire seismicity falls in a zone of 100 meter wide, which is actually the location error. So very localized seismicity. This is Gutenberg B-value associated with the microseismicity, but we know again from historical data that there are at least 5 magnitude 6 earthquakes in a century. If you add them to this data, they fall way above this line. This is the bump. That's the characteristic statistic. Here is another example from seismicity that precedes the eruption in Mount St. Helens. So there's a very nice seismogenic zone above the magma chamber with fixed dimension. It produces a bump. So in general, regional statistics tend to be dominated by power laws and temporal clustering, in part at least due to averaging. Statistics of large individual faults tend to include characteristic space-time scales within overall complex behavior. So in some cases, more complex mode switching actually occur, at least in the theory. We also believe there are some observational results for this, but they are inconclusive because we need very, very long time. Here's another example that illustrates persistent diversity, actually lack of universality. These are a focal mechanism. Jan explained briefly focal mechanisms. These are data associated with 120,000 earthquakes in Southern California. So these are stacked average focal mechanism from these different regions. The red are regions of compression, the white are extension, and it's not important what we see here other than the fact that you see differences between different regions that are characteristics of the regions. And these differences persist when you look at events of different magnitude beams. So now I'm plotting things differently. These are the eigenvectors of this focal mechanism, the important thing for different magnitude beams. And you see that they fall on top of each other for 20 years, and you have persistent differences from region to region. So detailed observations of the type I showed you and the type I'll show you further in the rest of the talk show clear persistent diversity when we know how to select domains rather than a single type of behavior. Improved understanding of this diversity requires analysis of evolutionary process and different dynamic regimes. And the benefit from all of this is that if we do it properly, we will be able to extract more information from the existing data. Instead of mixing everything and talking about fruit salad, we'll be able to separate the apples from the oranges, the bananas, you know. So here are the type of questions we would like to answer. For example, how do geometrical, mechanical, rheological properties of fault zones and the surrounding material related to different types of patterns in space-time energy domains? Are there connections between different patterns? These are not independent. If we see quasi-periodicity in time, what does it tell me about the frequency size statistics? And what does it tell me about other types of behaviors? How and when can we extrapolate results of low magnitude seismicity to large events? Typically, all we can measure is low magnitude. You know, you go anywhere and you put a network, and within a few years, you get something like this. But can you extrapolate it? This is very important. In some places, we believe we can, and in others, we cannot. So how can we distinguish? And on what timescale the seismic response to tectonic loading, which is relatively steady, stationary? For example, if we have mode switching, then it's not stationary. And the question, the last question, is the one I'm going to spend most of the talk about. How are foreshocks, main shock, aftershock sequences, which are very common in general, but how are they related to the brittleness of a given fault area and the regional, the overall seismic potential? As I showed you in the previous plot, we do not have the same type of aftershock sequences all the time, and we want to understand it a little bit better. So the main part of the talk will actually involve a method, non-parametric method, of identifying clusters of seismicity in the data. And then once we have this method and once we identify the clusters, we will want to study the clusters. And we will see that there are several distinct types of clusters. We don't have just one type of seismicity cluster. There will be three basic and the fourth one, which is mixed. And then we will want to ask ourselves, these different types of seismicity clusters, what produces them? What do they correlate with? Do they occur randomly in space? The answer will be no. They do not occur randomly in space. I can tell you right from the beginning, they will correlate with the heat flow, which controls how brittle a given region is. So we can measure the heat flow. Some places are hotter, some places are colder. This is a property that persists for hundreds of thousands of years. So it's not changing quickly. And if we learn how to recognize, which is what I'm going to show you here, we see that there are different types of seismicity cluster and different type of seismic potentials in this region. So that is a route to deriving more detailed information. So the data, again, this is the same data, actually a little bit more, just slightly later catalog, the same group. This is a map view, it's different colors. This is a map view of seismicity. Here is, so it's more compressed, but anyway, here is the San Andreas. It's still relatively quiet. We have seismicity off the main fault. This seismicity is a function of time. I highlighted here specific regions that we're going to study the whole thing, but we also will focus specific attention on these regions that are highlighted here, because in these regions, and only in these regions, we have both data on seismicity and on heat flow. Heat flow is a difficult measurement. To measure heat flow, you need to drill a little borehole inside the crust of the Earth and look at the thermal gradient. So it's done sporadically. We don't have even data. Also, seismicity does not fill space uniformly, as you see. So there are just a few regions. The one that I highlighted here, that's how it is selected. It's not selected to obtain some results. These are the places, all the places that we have data. So there are big differences in the heat flow between this place, Coso, and Salton Trough. There is geothermal energy production. They are hot. There is elevated heat. The other places are normal temperature. You're going to see that the seismicity clusters are very different. Okay, so what do we do? The whole method is based largely, at least the cluster, the separation to clusters, and then later we will classify the cluster. But the identification of cluster is based on measuring the distance between any two earthquakes using this equation, eta, that combines the spatial distance between hypocenters, r to the fractal dimension, the time between two earthquakes, and the size of one of them, the magnitude. So we have one measure of distance that was first introduced by Baeski and Patsuski that combines all of these different quantities associated with pairs of earthquakes in catalogs. And so this is time, distance to fractal dimension, and 10 to the minus b, that's the b value of the magnitude of the first event in the pair. Okay, so if you look at the log of this, you get, so there are two things. First of all, we are rescaling. We're going to separate this to rescale time and rescale distance. And the way we rescale, we simply divide the inter-event time and also the distance by half of that. You don't have to divide by half, but that's the way we do it. So we multiply tau by 10 to the minus bm to the power half, and we do the same with r. We try different ways of division. It will not affect the results that I'm showing you. So we will be working with rescale time and rescale distance, and essentially this quantity that we are rescaling the time and the distance with is proportional to the radius of the first event. This is not necessarily the only way to explain it. Maybe Joren will explain it to you differently, but it is proportional to the length of the rupture area of the first event. So that's what we are using to rescale. And now our distance eta is just a product of the rescale time and rescale distance. If you look at the log of eta, it's of course the sum. And so we're going to use this coordinate system for the next 10 slides or so. Rescale distance, rescale time. And what we do now, we go for any event in the catalog. We are working right now with a catalog of 120,000 events for this particular analysis. Any event, we identify a parent of the event. How do we identify parent? We measure the distance from this event to all previous events. Okay, and we find the one previous event that is closest to this earthquake J in this combined dimension, that's what we call parent of the event. Now, we know from, we can see what we can expect from simple models. So if you just start with synthetic seismicity, you produce seismicity that is this heterogeneous in space, but homogeneous in time, Poisson homogeneous process, and you use this coordinate system that I showed you, Riskel distance and time, all the distances between pairs of events fall above this diagonal line. So that's what we get from Poisson. We know how to recognize Poisson. We're going to call it shortly background events. These are events that are not clustered, they are background. Seismicity has this plus something else, and that something else is also seen with a model. This is a generic model that just has the Gutenberg-Richter and the Omori law. It's called the ETAS model. So the ETAS model combines events occur in some rate, Poisson rate, and every time that event is generated, you pull the magnitude for Gutenberg-Richter statistics, then you produce Omori law aftershock decays, and that gives you a population of synthetic earthquakes. So when you do this with the ETAS model, we get this Poisson branch of the seismicity, and we also get these events, which are closer to the origin, both in space and time, than what you would expect from the Poisson. So these are all clusters, clustered event. We're going to call this the clustered branch. This will be the Poisson or the background branch. So these ETAS model provide good generic results if we want to compare with some more detailed model of the type I'm going to show you in a second. But in fact, does not explain the seismicity properly. Some things are missing in the ETAS model. This is generic again. It's universal. It does not recognize difference between different regions of space. So when we look at real data, this is now real data, that's 120,000 earthquakes that we are considering, we get again these two lobes. We can put a separation. There is a cloud here, so you can argue where exactly the line should be. It's not going to affect the results that I'm going to show you if you move it a little bit. There is this branch here on top. These are background events. The distances are relatively large. They are as large as you would expect from Poisson. And here, these are clustered events, where distances between pairs of events are closer. They are shorter than what you would expect from the Poisson model. So now, having this, we can identify relatively large distances or closer distances, and we can now use this definition to break the catalog to clusters. Okay. So the way we do this, we start by simply plotting the events as a function of time. This is schematic. Time is going to the right here. This is the first event you consider, and you have all of these events occurring later. We measure the distances between each event and its parent, and I told you before how we identify the parents. And now we ask ourselves, we look at all of these distances, and we ask ourselves, where does it sit in this previous diagram, in this diagram? Is the distance sitting here, or is it sitting here? If the distance sits here, we call it a weak link, and we will actually shortly disconnect them. So we are just going to keep groups of events that are connected internally to each other by the strong links, so that the distances are below the diagonal. And in this particular example, you get three clusters. One cluster consists of a single event, and then you have this cluster, and a smaller one right here. When we have clusters, we have these situations. Either we have multiple events, so we call it a family, or we have just one event that's going to be a single. If we have a family, the biggest event in the cluster we will call main shock. We just want to use terminology that is consistent with what people have been using for 100 years now. So the biggest event we'll call main shock. Everything before in that cluster we will call foreshocks, and everything after within this cluster we will call aftershocks. Okay? So just a little test quickly. I'm not going to spend much detail on this, but this is published. There are extensive appendixes on that. This is what you get from the ETAS model, so we can just generate it synthetically. There are clearly clustered events here. That's the product of applying our method and just keeping the main shock. So in other words, declustering. So you see that it's doing a good job, and this is a little bit more detailed. We know this is a synthetic catalog. We know exactly each event, who are the parents and who are the offspring, and et cetera. So you can see that we do fairly good in identifying the event types, event type of main shock. With identifying the parent, we are doing okay, especially for moderate size events, and we are not doing so good when we go to the biggest event, because there are just very few of them. Okay? So now we are going to apply this method. We already applied it. But the next thing is we get all of these clusters. And the question is, we are interrogating the internal properties of the cluster. So do we get the same type of cluster everywhere? The answer is no. I will show you that we have these four types. There are clusters that we call burst-like clusters that essentially have almost no foreshocks, and the aftershocks are dominated by one generation. So it's like what you would get when you throw a stone at a glass. You get all of those cracks. And this is what we would expect from brittle type failure. And in fact, I'm jumping ahead, but these will tend to occur primarily in parts of the crust that are cold. So it's consistent. We will get what we call swarm-like clusters. So the swarm-like clusters are very different. There will be many foreshocks, then there will be a main shock, then there will be many generations of aftershocks, not just one. So it's just we're going to keep on going and going and going. We have singles that I already showed you. They are spread all over. Some of the singles are artifact of minimum of resolution. So if I added more instruments, I would record more. But not all of them, because some of our singles are large magnitude, relatively large. And we know that the resolution of the network can detect, for example, in Southern California, we can detect all earthquakes larger than magnitude 2. So we do have singles. We think that the singles reflect stress regime. If you just have an event in a region that is surrounded by valley of stress, the stress is relatively low, there will not be aftershocks. So not every event is doing exactly the same. And then we have the most famous, actually, the cluster of the largest events. These are the data that almost everybody is analyzing. And what we are arguing is that these, the largest events, like Landers, Paul was talking about Landers or the Tohoku, now we are actually mixing many different types of clusters. So these are basic modes of clusters, but the large events occur over very large areas. They put stress on motion of large areas, so we are getting averages. Actually, we are getting a mixture of all of these, okay? So in some example illustrations, here is a map of Southern California. I'm just choosing two events that are almost the same magnitude. One event, this one, in the San Bernardino Mountains is in a cold area, relatively cold area, magnitude 5.5. And look at this. This is the spatial distribution. This is a map, and there are connections between the events. So it does not occupy a very large region of space, relatively speaking, compared to this event, which is almost the same magnitude, and it's roughly isotropic, roughly. So the second event is in the Salton Trough, where there's a geothermal field. It's very hot. It looks like this. It's not isotropic. There are these long channels. And in fact, this area, it's almost the same magnitude, but the size, the spatial extent of the events within this cluster belonging to this main shock is much, much larger. If we look at occurrence as a function of time, here is our cold event in the San Bernardino Mountain. There is one foreshock before the main shock. Actually, we identify a parent. So there's one foreshock. Then we have the main shock right here. And then we have essentially almost all the aftershocks are one generation. That's what you see with these lines, okay? That's for the cold area, San Bernardino. The event in the hot region, there are many foreshocks. There is a sequence of foreshocks. You just keep going and accelerating and accelerating. Then you have a main shock. And then there are many generations of aftershocks. So it's just a sequence that is oozing, keep on oozing around, as opposed to this very robust burst-like rupture. These type of differences we see in tens of thousands of clusters based on the data that I showed you. I'm just illustrating with some examples. So we measure, we quantify the differences with many measures. Actually, we measured everything that we could. But we find that the most informative difference is the depth of a tree, okay? So if you start with the first event and you calculate how many generations you need to go to get to the last event, in other words, the depth of the leaf with respect to the trunk in each of the sequence, what we see is that in burst-like ruptures, the typical depth is four generations. In swarm, these are the same events. I'm showing you all, I'm illustrating all of this with the same two events. In this case, there are 30 generations, a very, very big difference. So it's totally different character. Here is a summary of average leaf depth versus cluster size. So these are the number of events inside the cluster for the cold areas, relatively cold areas, or the areas that we identify, I didn't show you yet the heat flow, but the areas that we call burst. So in the burst-like clusters, the population size increase, the leaf depth saturated 5, okay? Even when we have 1,000 events. With the swarms, the leaf depth continues to increase with the size of the population. If you calculate, if you look at ETA's model, the model I showed you before, and you calculate the leaf depth, we get saturation at about 4 or 5. So ETA's model produces only burst-like clusters. It's very popular in seismology. It does not account for the swarm-type clusters, which are all over. So where do these things occur? Do they occur randomly? The answer is no. So here is the map of the heat flow. And as I told you before, Kozo and the Salton Trough are hot. Everything else is relatively cold. This is a smoothed map from the heat flow measurements. If you now look, it's the same map, but I'm still using colors, but I changed now. Now the color denotes the leaf depths. So you see very clearly that the leaf depths, which indicate the type of cluster, correlates very strongly. It occurs in the same geographical place where we have, here is heat flow, here is the leaf depth. So the hot areas give us swarm-type clusters. It's not astonishing, it's what we expect, but we are showing it here robustly using tons of data, and I think a very good method for identifying. So here is our formal statistical test that the two populations in the burst type and the swarm type are actually the same. This is an hypothesis, a null hypothesis, and we reject this hypothesis with all of these different measures. So in conclusions, I showed you that seismic clusters in Southern California have 4 different types of clusters. They are burst-like, they are swarm-type, they are singles, and then there are the largest sequences that actually mix different types of basic clusters. I did not get into the detailed differences. There are differences in time-space magnitude. I just emphasized the leaf depths. There is clear relation to physical properties. They are not spread randomly. They are not mixed. So swarm-like clusters tend to occur in relatively cold, hot areas, areas that have reduced effective viscosity of the crust. The burst-like clusters occur in areas with relatively high viscosity, brittle areas. These results are consistent with theoretical expectation from a damage geology model that has this viscosity in the model. So the general conclusion is that there are limits, of course, to universality. And by recognizing these type of differences, since they are persisting, we can extract more information and use the data in a better way to, for example, calculate seismic hazard. Thank you.
A nice presentation, Professor Panzian.
Thank you.
Regarding the burst-like clusters and the swarm-like cluster, which one is more detrimental?
Which one is
more detrimental to?
Which is more destructive?
Yeah. Yes.
The burst. The burst-like clusters are more destructive, and they also have. It's interesting, the number of events in the swarm type clusters tend to be larger, they just keep on going. The burst-like cluster have larger maximum magnitude. So they occur in colder areas, the seismic potential in these areas is higher, even though there are more events in the swarm-like clusters.
Thank you.
The bursts are more destructive, or higher seismic potential.
Thank you.
I have a few comments. One, of course, that what I analyzed and we analyzed are global tectonic earthquakes. And this earthquake may be landings, is a global tectonic. Other earthquakes are connected with volcanic processes, with thermal So those are different populations.
Of course, that's my point.
I agree, most likely there is a dependence between thermal flux and earthquakes, but...
This is the first time you agree with me on anything.
Let's
stop right here, Shek.
So after this positive note,
you are not going to agree. All right.
I want to mention rather negative. John von Neumann once told that with four parameters he can fit an elephant. Yeah. So here you are fitting using many parameters.
How many parameters do I have? I only use the separation, the key parameters. Remember?
Look, simplest window, circle, requires three parameters. Position of the center of the circle and radius of the circle. Yeah. Just show your windows.
No, the windows are arbitrary. I beg the difference. This is the only parameter we use, and it comes from the data.
No, you obtained it by windowing seismicity.
No, this is the entire Southern California catalog. This is our parameter. And by the way, we have similar work on global scale, and we certainly see differences between mid-ocean ridges for the same reason that I say they are hotter. We have only one parameter.
Certain mid-ocean ridges are different. Then, final remark. The final test of your predictive power of your model is prediction.
Of course.
So you need...
I make a prediction here. The prediction is that the burst-like will continue. These regions will continue to have burst-like or swarm-like for the next 10,000 years.
No.
This is a persistent property.
You need to take regions where you say, okay, here I expect such a seismicity, and then we look. What do we observe?
Yeah.
And propose objective test, whether it's true or not.
We have a very clear prediction here. Yep.
Yeah, okay. Other question? So you talked about the swarm-like ones being associated with hotter regions and the burst-like ones being associated with cold. So could that be, and then you showed it as heat flux. So I'm assuming that things were the same temperature before and you're observing them getting hotter and getting colder, or do you think that they were the different temperatures before they started?
No, it's just different temperature. The crust, if I look, show you back the map, so there are just different, there are different regions in Southern California and everywhere in the world have different heat flux because there are sources of heat. Magma,
okay.
For example,
so that's
up.
A base state that it's hot.
It's a base state, and it changes. So we have the bears like are brittle failures, the swarm like are brittle ductile. It's
so
mixed.
There's probably some material. So you're saying that the underlying material properties in that region
it's the underlying,
could well be quite
the underlying
different.
Average temperature is different.
And therefore there's different material
and therefore
properties.
The different rheology and therefore the okay. different types of clusters that we get, yes. It's not changing within the cluster. As I said, there's a clear prediction. This is a persistent property that will stay 50, 100, 200,000 years.
Okay.
I have a question on the number of parameters. So how do you determine the tree structure of the, because you can identify families, but then how can, I don't see why you cannot have loops, or how do you determine generations?
Because for each event, we know the parents, so there are no loops.
So how do you know
it's
the parents?
It's only one family. Each event has a single parent, and that's the previous event that is closest in this using this distance eta that I showed that combines space-time and magnitude.
Okay.
So there are no loops. There is a clear genealogy here. Now, of course, it's not perfect. We may misidentify a few parents here and there. But, and we are, in fact, we have a version that we have multiple parents and with probabilities. Again, the main features remain the same. There are some changes, but the main features that I showed remain the same.
Thank you.
More questions?
Any more questions? I was just curious, if you had to design an experiment to
lab experiment?
Yeah.
It's very easy, just change the temperature. So, for example, or you need something with effective viscosity. Actually, when we, the original, yeah, you take some sort of a solid that is very cold, and of course you need to have events that don't, that are not system size, so you can actually get aftershocks and things like this, okay? So you have to somehow put some very strong barriers that will stop event from breaking the entire system. If I predict that if you shear it under constant loading, if the temperature is cold, you will get burst type events, okay? There will be fragmentation, there will be, you know, main shock, and then the whole thing will fall. But if it's the hotter it is, the more you will move to swarm type behavior.
But it has not yet been.
It has not been done.
Done, okay. Yep. One question.
Did you apply the same procedure to other regions in the world?
Yeah.
Greece,
so we Japan? Did. We applied this globally, actually, to the whole world. We get results that are similar to what I just showed you for Southern California. We can understand the result in terms of average heat. So we get one type of clusters concentrated along the mid-ocean ridges. We have other types of cluster. Burst type cluster tend to be inside the continents, okay? We haven't published it because at the same time, we are trying to improve a little bit the method, make it a bit more robust with respect to errors in the catalogs, and also maybe allow, we know that we don't perfectly identify the correct parent. So we are, on one hand, we are trying to improve the model, but yes, we apply it to the whole world. And also some other specific regions, and we get similar type. There's an agreement, there's a consistency between this. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to follow up on the, I don't think that the correct parent, right? The model you're using, right, for the ETAS model, if you simulate it as a branching process, you know, obviously know what the parent is.
Right.
But the obviously the, it's just one way to simulate this non-homogeneous Poisson process. So in principle, you have many parents, right? So the test is a little bit, has to be a little bit cautious there, because
the test with ETAS.
Yeah, the test with ETAS, because if you want to say, well, I know what the parent is, you only really know it probabilistically. So it's just a note of caution. Right?
Yeah, we tested against ETAS just because we can do it. With ETAS, you know everything. It's not an ultimate test, of course. In fact, I have a model that Karen knows very well because we've been working with this model for many years now. And this type of model also produces this kind of, it's a bit more complicated actually. And it's not ETAS. And we'll see, we can make tests with that model as well.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, let's thank him again for a very interesting talk. And the last talk will be given by Jørn Davidson. And he is going to talk about earthquake triggering and temporal organization of avalanches during rock fracture.